Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast, where we take you inside the awesome world of mountain biking. I can't quite believe this, but the Downtime Podcast is 1 year old. I want to just say a massive thank you to everyone that's been listening, everyone that's been in touch, sent us lovely messages, commented on our social media, gave us an iTunes review. It's absolutely awesome to hear from so many of you, to know that you're enjoying what we're doing. It really makes a massive difference and gives me the motivation to keep trying to find you good guests and keep churning out the podcast. So thank you so much for that. If you're not already, then don't forget to follow us on social media. You can find us, just look for Downtime Podcast. We're on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter. And also, if you've got time, an iTunes review goes a long way. It really helps people find the podcast and people know what the podcast is about. So head over to iTunes and leave us a quick review there. Okay, so we've got another great guest for you this week, and it's Ollie Morris. Ollie is an interesting chap in that he has a few different roles. He's an elite downhiller in the UK. He's the team manager for the Intense Saddleback team. He's a mountain bike skills coach for ProRide, and he's also a corporate trainer. So he brings a really interesting perspective and covers lots of different areas of the sport. We talked about quite a lot of stuff in this episode. One of the interesting key things in there, I think, is the mental side of mountain biking and also the techniques that Ollie himself has used on that side to help him go faster and get better race results. We talk about some common coaching mistakes, and also we talk about what he learned while he was behind the scenes with British Cycling at the World Champs in Cairns last year. So without further ado, here's episode 27 with Ollie Morris. Ollie Morris, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. Thanks for taking time to come and join us today.
Hey, Chris. Yeah, thanks for the invite. Looking forward to speaking to you.
Cool. So I'm aware that maybe not many of our audience will know a huge amount about you. So we start off, just give us a bit of your background, kind of how you got into riding and your journey into mountain biking, I guess.
Yeah, sure. I suppose I probably got into riding, or I think the answer is never stopped when I was a kid, like probably many of us passionate mountain bikers. I think the first thing I did actually was a race. So it was an Aston Hill race, and struggled my way down on the wrong bike, on the wrong tyres, on the wrong everything, as I think we've all done. Got into it then, and actually made the choice at that stage of my life, or as I got a little bit older, that I didn't want to have a job in my hobby, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So I made that choice. Worked my way into actually becoming a trainer, a corporate trainer, where I specialised in more recent years and still do in management skills. I suppose I spent 10 or 15 years nearly in that kind of area, still racing. And as I sort of got into my later 20s, really started putting quite a lot of focus into riding itself and racing. At that stage, I then turned elite and realized how hard it was when you're in elite against you're standing on the start line at either a national or World Cups, and you've got all the big names around you. But kind of got a buzz for it, really, and at that point wanted to kind of then progress and actually start, although it's in my sort of later 20s and early 30s, actually start progressing into working in the sport. So then sort of jumping ahead more recently, in the past couple of years, I now manage the Intense Racing UK race team, which is really fun, and we've had a great first year. I do mountain bike coaching, so I've kind of used my training skills and taken them into coaching people on push bikes, which is nice to kind of join my career with my passion. And then obviously still race, and it gives me, to be honest, more opportunity to be in an environment to be able to race at a more competitive level.
Good stuff. And is that mainly downhill racing for you, or are you doing a bit of enduro as well?
Downhill's my focus. Yeah. I just love it. It's what I've always done. But with the team, we do a couple of enduros a year, things like the Ard Rock Enduro and stuff like that, which is great fun, the kind of festival events. And it's a nice change.
Cool. So how did the Intense team manager role come around then? Tell us a bit about that.
I don't know if I want to say the honest way or the other way. I think I'm going to, I'd probably do the honest way, Chris. So I heard on the grapevine that it was the team was being formed, and I'd heard some of the riders that were sort of being spoken to at that point. And this was back in, so this would have been 2016 season. And I thought, oh, yeah, I fancy a piece of that. But knowing with my results at the time that, you know, not being a top elite, would it be possible to race on a team like that? So the honest way is I actually emailed and spoke to, in more depth, Saddleback, who owned the team, and kind of gave them a bit more than just I want to ride and I want free bikes, which I think can be quite common for people who want sponsorship. And I actually went to them with a bit of a proposal about what I can offer them about with the sort of management and logistics and communications side of things with the team. Plus the side that at the time I'd just started mountain bike coaching as well. So the sort of coaching side of things that I could bring and the sort of publicity through that. And the fact that I'd be at all the races and a part of the team and from a rider perspective as well. So I kind of gave them a bit more than just, I want to come and race on your team. For one reason or another, it was right place, right time, and it paid off, and things progressed into sort of managing the team and figuring it out from there, really.
Yeah, nice. That's a super cool little project to have. So give us a bit of insight then. What does a team manager have to do? What's involved in that role?
I don't know. Can you answer that for me? do you know what? It's many things, I would say. So I'd say it's different for different team managers with different teams and different setups. So the role I've got, so I work with Saddleback, who are a UK distributor. So that they obviously own the team. They are, but financially, obviously, they are the ones that input the money into the team. And at the end of the day, they make the final decisions. You know, they're the kind of, it's their ownership. But so my relationship with that is that I'm kind of, sometimes I call myself the middleman, because I'm basically the communication both out of Saddleback from brand managers and the people who run the team internally, out to the riders, of which last year we had 6 riders and myself. So one thing is communication, and that's often a tough thing. You know, you've got many riders with different goals, different wants out of the sport, should I say, different ages and experiences, getting that communication out that way. As well, though, you've got going in, so communication from the riders back into Saddleback, back to them. On top of that, though, the logistical side of things is huge. So making sure that everybody is where they need to be and that they have a roof over their head at the various events. And then I've got kind of, you know, big side of it for me is definitely the performance side of things. So supporting the riders with their performance. Now, they all have trainers and most of the team use Ben Plenge as a trainer. But on top of that, I like to bring the performance team together and work with the riders on track and try and help them a little bit with the mind game as well.
So apologies for the audio in that section. We did manage to fix it. So hopefully the rest of the interview you'll find is a lot better.
And then the final thing with the team, I suppose final says that there's nothing else. There's obviously many other things around it. But then the last thing that we do, though, is around presentation. So Saddleback and, you know, with the brands such as Intense and Troy Lee, presentation of the team is really, really important, as you can imagine. So that's kind of the final thing that I kind of oversee.
Interesting. So who did you have on the team last year? It was quite an impressive team, right?
Yeah. I unfortunately, I wasn't involved in the selection process, which I wish I could say I was. in downhill, we had Joe Breeden and Charlie Hatton. So Joe was in junior and Charlie was going into his first year elite. Mm-hmm. And then we also had Andrew Titley, so a legend, you know, so the other end of their career as such, which is great to have on the team. And then in elite female, we had Jess Greaves, and then obviously myself. And then in enduro, we had Sam Flockhart and AJ Jones. From the enduro side of things. So yeah, it was a good team, and we did some calculations. I haven't got it in front of me, but it was something like, I think, 30 odd podiums through the year, of which 10 of them were I think 10 of them were first place or something like that. But don't hold me to those figures.
Yeah, awesome. That's impressive. So what do you attend all of the races that the team are taking part in, or just certain ones? How does that work?
Yeah, good question. So I attend all the British, and unfortunately don't attend the World Cups, mainly down to kind of budget side of things. But also we're, you know, our team, our focus is UK. It's a UK distribution in Saddleback, and that's where their focus of selling bikes is. So yeah, that's hence the reason they don't send me to the European ones.
That makes sense. And what do you think attracts a team to a rider? I know there's loads of people out there that want to get sponsored, and I think a lot of brands get, you know, many people getting them in touch with them and asking for product or asking for sponsorship. What do you think it takes these days to get picked up by a team?
Sure. Yeah. So to be picked up by a team, yeah, really good question, to be honest. Now, I would say there's an obvious one being results. And, you know, if at the end of the day, if you're getting on the podium, you're getting the pictures, you're getting the publicity, and you are, you're going to be a good asset to the team. On top of that, and I actually had a conversation with somebody about this the other day, another team manager, and it was actually around, well, what's more important, results or somebody that does great media, if that makes sense? So somebody that's, you know, very regular and getting the sort of the hits and the likes that that's needed. I guess probably I'm, you know, of the old school, which is around, yeah, let's have the results first and the media on top. And this person I was speaking to and their opinion was, you know, well, actually, let's have the media first and see if the results follow. So there's a slight opinion to that. And that probably would reflect in the type of team that is being run very clearly. So yeah, results and media being two, but one of the real important things for us in our selection process is definitely around the type of person, so the team fit and their personality, how they are. You know, are they going to chip in? Are they going to actually be a good asset to the team on top of, you know, committing to their riding? But are they one of the team that are actually going to support as well? So yeah, personality, I'd say, would be a really, really, really big thing.
And how important is their personality when they're at events, you know, meeting people from the public?
Yeah, extremely important. You know, we've always wanted to be in the pits and stuff, although, you know, especially the likes of in the downhill pits, when you've got the likes of Charlie, who obviously has won the series, the British National Series last year. And Joe, you know, getting second in the juniors, when you've got guys like that, you know, they're serious, you know, they're taking the sport seriously. But what they still need to do is, and what they do is that they balance that with being open, letting people have a bounce on their bike, you know, and generally, you know, I guess dividing their time between, right, I'm head down, I'm doing my job here, I'm doing what I want to be doing. And then also, you know, the socializing and being open to others.
Cool. And you mentioned Charlie Hatton, obviously had a pretty good first year in Elite and has gone on to move to the Trek Atherton Racing team. What do you think it is about Charlie that kind of makes him stand out? What's he doing differently that's enabling him to perform at that level straight off in Elite and to attract, you know, sponsors like Trek?
Yeah. So Charlie, he is, the one thing I've always said with Charlie is I've forgotten he was only 18, 19 years old last year when on our team. And that's because he's definitely got, you know, quite a wise head on his shoulders. So that's definitely one thing. But with him, there's some fundamental things. One was the consistency of the way he would work a race weekend. You know, he would know, and especially it was very obvious when it came down to the kind of last hour to an hour and a half before his race run, you'd know exactly how long before his race run what Charlie would be doing. You know, whether it's obvious things like his warm up, or, you know, I'd know the exact time that he'd be putting his headphones on to like start getting in the zone and things. So one thing was definitely the consistency of what he was doing, so that there was nothing new. You know, it was just he could work his way through the weekend. Managing another real important thing was hit with him was managing his expectations. Now, people won't believe what I'm going to say here, but Charlie and my conversations at the beginning of the season, bearing in mind he'd come from, I think he was sixth overall in junior at world level. It was a lot more successful in the UK, but sixth overall in the world at junior. To go up to elite and step from that sixth is quite a big jump, you know. So mine and his conversation was around, you know, let's get qualifying for a few of these World Cups and, you know, make your way in, and hopefully by the end of the year we can break into that top 50, top 40 group kind of thing. And that was very much from him, you know. He was very realistic and very honest. So he'd set himself, and I suppose the team then had the expectations around him of those type of results. He was looking at, you know, hopefully getting into the top 10 at national level as well. Those expectations, because although some people would say to me, oh, Ollie, but that's not, you know, you're not reaching for, like, his goals aren't high enough, and he's not going to, you know, if he aims for top 40, top 50 in the world, he's only going to get top 60, top 70. But actually what it did is it just removed the pressure from him. So he could just relax, ride as fast as he could, and saw what happened. And that's what happened with him. So yeah, I'd say his maturity, his consistency, and and his expectation setting were probably the three key things that got him through this year. Oh yeah, and the fact he's just really blooming fast on a bike. Not forgetting that bit.
Yeah, can't argue with that. Yeah. So how much of that, you know, that approach, that kind of process and goal setting stuff comes from your background in training and corporate work?
Yeah, good question. I'd say, you know, with Charlie, I'd say a lot of that he had quite nailed himself. Like I say, his wise shoulders came, were pretty strong with it. Sorry, his right wise head on his shoulders, sorry, was pretty good with that. So, but around that the corporate world, everything's figures and goal setting, and especially in training, you know, it's very important. The expectation setting side of things is absolutely huge. So, yes, it definitely comes in. And actually, that question got me thinking, to be fair, Chris, because, yeah, it probably has more than I have known it has, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. Mm. What I've heard kind of two different schools of thought, I guess, with how to approach racing. Some people talk about goal setting and having aims, and other people talk about having a process and doing your best to execute that process through a race weekend. Mm. What's your thought on those two maybe slightly different approaches? Is there one that's better than the other? Do they fit well together? Where do you come down on that?
Yeah, I definitely err more towards the kind of process side of things, but actually I think both of them can tie in quite well. I've actually done a bit of work with the chimp paradox or chimp management, and I'm sure many people have read the book. And what they speak about.
Oh, sorry. So I was going to say, give us a little 30-second kind of overview of what the chimp paradox is about. So it's Stephen Peters from British Cycling's book, right?
Yeah. And he, in simple, it's about how managing emotions, both in life and obviously for my purpose in reading, it was around, you know, how it is in riding and how you can manage them at times where potentially it can be very stressed. You know, you've got, you know, performance to at an event or whatever. So yeah, it's all about the managing of the emotions, the mental side of the sport.
Okay. And the chimp is your kind of irrational self, right?
Absolutely.
Your,
yeah.
Emotional self. Yeah.
Yeah. You've got your chimp and you've got a computer, and then it's all about kind of reprogramming your computer to manage your chimp effectively. It's before you've read it, speaking in that language does sound a little bit funny, I think, to be fair, but it's once you've read the book or, you know, worked with one of the mentors, it's a real good way, like I say, of kind of managing your mind really, in pressure situations. The side of things relating to this kind of goal setting or process goals and things that you speak about a second ago is that what they do in chimp management, it speaks about separating goals to dreams. So a chimp needs motivation and needs encouragement and needs, you know, is if you imagine a chimp in the wild, you know, if it sees something, it will be very excited and excitable, and it is your motivator. So it's a very good thing in that respect. So if you have a dream, you know, of, you know, being world champion one day or something like that, which could be somebody like Charlie's dream, then it motivates your chimp. So it motivates your chimp to get up early in the morning and do your training. And, you know, it's the thing that it can kind of like ride off as such.
Yeah.
But if your goal is to be world champion, well, there's probably a few hundred people in the world with a potential chance and a few hundred people in the world with that same dream. So whatever happens, there's going to be a hell of a lot of people that are going to have a feeling and a feeling of disappointment. So what chimp management does is it just divides that. So it says, there's the dream, that's the motivator. Now let's get down to the process stuff about what we need to do, and let's hit those process goals to give us the best chance in succeeding and in being that world champion.
Okay. So can you give us an example then maybe of some of the process goals that you might put in place for someone who's looking to progress either through enduro or downhill racing?
Yeah, I definitely can. So it would be separate from how detailed you get into that. So okay. You've got your categories as such, haven't you? So you'll have, you know, around your, if you like, your training side of things, so your fitness and your strength and conditioning side of things, you'll have some then very specific process goals in there. You'll have training, obviously, on the bike. So then you'll have your process goals on there. And it could just be that you want to ride a local track at a certain time, you know, that you need to beat your time before or to be on a competitive time with somebody else. But it can also be even more process than that. Like, I'm going to do 100 downhill runs over the next 2 months. You know, it's time on bike as such. So you've got that kind of skill side of things. And then, you know, again, you could even have your process goals around your mind and your mind training. So I think it's more sort of like your high level categories first, and then what you're going to do within each of those, which again can get extremely detailed. And I think I haven't read all of it, but from the British Cycling Marginal Gain side of things, you know, they're looking into absolutely every single piece to make sure that they've got everything in place.
Yeah, definitely. So is this something that you've been able to kind of apply to your own riding and racing?
For sure, yeah. So I actually went to chimp management originally about 2.5 years ago, probably. And it was, for me, purely just the fact that I'm 33 years old now and I'm racing against the Charlie Hattons of this world at the age of 19. So I think I'm almost twice his age, not quite, but yeah. And for me, you know, I have many different things, different responsibilities, different fears, different emotions. And for me, it was just wanting to be able to manage those more effectively. So I could, yeah, remove a little bit of the fear and get on with, you know, what I enjoy doing, that's riding bikes.
So give us some examples of how you've been able to apply it then to help you work through some of those fears.
Yeah.
Any specifics that are easy to kind of explain?
Yeah. The detail is untrue. So the way that we went, or the mentor that I worked with, the process we took was we started off with some very race-related things. So things around mental warm-up. So it was things literally like ask your chimp what he's offering at the moment. So what emotional things is he offering at a race? So it may be, you know, I don't want to crash, or, you know, I really want to beat these other riders, or it might be things around that. Then you would have to, around that mental warm-up, you would have to then answer those emotional thoughts with logic. So you might say, well, what's the logic? You know, and some things are, well, you can't decide what everybody else is going to do in this category. So, you know, don't think about the other riders. Crashing, you can say, yeah, it's part of the sport. But, you know, you ask yourself the question, am I open to this risk? Am I happy to do this risk? And obviously the answer will be yes, and so on. So you can kind of work through those kind of emotional things as a mental warm-up. Then the other parts of it, the mental warm-up, was around visualization, adding a little bit of positivity, but not just saying I'm great, more positivity around like, crikey, look what I'm doing. I'm in a lovely sport with great people. And, you know, often if it's in Europe or whatever and you're racing, it's, you know, I'm traveling and I've got the social side of it, you know, so it's about looking at all of the kind of positives of why you're actually doing this sport, other than obviously just about to throw yourself down a mountain. So you kind of, so there was the mental warm-up side of things for sure, which was a huge thing. We spent a lot of time around that with this, with the mentor for the first, I'd say, probably 6 months. But actually, and this is the biggest thing, that after that, what he then did is work more on life values and beliefs. And without, you know, depending on how deep you want to go into this really, but it's about looking at, okay, so who am I and what do I actually believe in? And it effectively says, well, you know, how do you make sure that you are happy first and that everything in your life is right? In other words, we probably should have done this the other way around, but I don't think my mentor would have got me if he'd have started speaking about life and beliefs, because I just wanted to go quicker on a bike. That's why I went to him and was like, how do I go faster on a bike? So we spoke about, we worked on this and changed all that. And it literally did give me quite a perspective change on both life and my racing. Once that's then fixed, you can then focus more on racing. But what I think the challenge is that, and this is where chimp management work helped so much, is that you can just think that your only thing you need is trying to get down that hill as quickly as possible. And actually, that's probably a very small thing in your life, but it just gives you quite a lot of adrenaline. It gives you a good rush. And to be fair, pleases your chimp, gives it a game to play. So an example, you know, to go into that a bit further, but a chimp management mentor, he spoke about Chris Hoy, and he said that, you know, Chris Hoy, when he was going for his Olympics gold medals, and apparently they spent years with him trying to make him realize that he was a 30-year-old bloke wearing a leotard, riding in circles on a bike. And yeah. And when you put it like that, it suddenly doesn't seem very important anymore. And actually, the fact that he's healthy and happy and his family life and social life is actually 10 times more important than the bike. And it's and a lot of the chimp management stuff was kind of separating the two. You know, it's saying that's your game, go and enjoy it, but let's make sure that life's stable first.
Interesting. So how has that impacted you in a race situation then? So there's the two aspects. There's the mental warm-up piece you talk about, and then there's the overall kind of more focused, more appreciation of what's important to you. How has that impacted how you feel at a race weekend?
I'd like to say perfectly, and I now don't have any worries when I'm at the top. I just sit there relaxed and absolutely fine. But at the end of the day, I am still human and I still do have that emotional thought at the top. So that's part of it. But for me, it definitely changed my perspective. A lot of people end up jumping out of the sport and out of racing. And I've had many conversations with people saying, I don't race anymore. I just ride to have fun. And I probably 5 years ago was maybe got close to that sort of point myself, where I was like, oh, I, you know, it's just too much. The boiling pot's just going to boil over and I just got to walk away. But my perspective has now changed, actually, it's the game, isn't it? You know, it's okay. In my case, it's not riding around in circles like Chris Hoy, but it's just riding a bike downhill. It doesn't actually matter in the slightest. So I can just enjoy it more. And that's how it's impacted me. Just my enjoyment of a race weekend is a lot higher.
Interesting. Well, that's good in itself, but has your result improved off the back of that?
Oh, yeah.
Do you think you're riding better?
I like your style. Absolutely. Yeah. I see what you mean. So one is have fun and then is it actually faster? Yeah. So definitely I was at the back of Elite for sure. And questioning whether I should sort of stay in Elite. And then last year, I think my best result was 7th at Llangollen at a national level. So, nice. And I think overall was about 11th in the national series. So, whereas before that, nowhere near that. Yeah.
Cool. Huge change. So having more fun and doing better. Win-win.
Exactly. Yeah. Long process to get there.
Yeah. Interesting. So we'll have to dig out a link to the chimp. I think it's called the Chimp Paradox, but I'll check that and I'll put a link in the show notes on the website.
For sure.
So people can dig it out if they want to have a read. So it sounds like they have mentors available if you get in touch with them through the book, I guess.
Yeah. Or just online, you know, there's the Chimp Paradox, I guess, corporation almost, you know, it's quite large in the UK. Okay. So yeah, you can get them through there.
Interesting. I've often wondered how many of the top flight riders are doing things like this around kind of mental mental training or mental preparation, because it feels like sport at that level is a lot of it is in the head. You see riders, you know, try for ages and then it suddenly clicks, or they'll be doing really well for a while and then they'll suddenly kind of fade away and the results will go away from them. Have you got any feel for, you know, are people using this kind of stuff, like, or is this kind of quite I guess unusual in the mountain bike world?
From what I know, from the people I speak to, I would definitely say it's unusual. And maybe to go back a bit in the sport, and you know, I've been in the sport now for getting on for 20 years, and it was only up until about 3 to 5 years ago where it was seen as a cool thing, or should I just say okay to say that you train for the sport, fitness wise, you know. So it's, you know, and it's at the same time when we start getting called athletes rather than mountain bikers, you know. So this whole kind of change of like, yeah, we're not just, you know, hooning a bike downhill. You don't need to be fit. You just ride downhill, and you know, it's uncool. And it was pretty obvious that even, you know, back in the day, Nicolas Vuillaz, the reason he was smoking everybody else because he was probably the only guy that actually was training for the sport. And it's pretty obvious even now that the guys that are right at the top, how probably their focus to training is just higher than the others. You know, they can basically keep that intensity of speed out the gate the same to the through to the finish line, you know. So you go back and you think, well, yeah, 5 years ago or around that, you know, trainers weren't even a thing. But now, you know, you'd only have to go on Instagram if any downhillers page, and you'll see everyone posting through the winter of them lifting weights and rowing machines and whatever else, you know. So now that's seen as okay. And I think the mind side of things in sport, in any sport, is you know, and in corporate world, to be honest, you know, we speak about sort of mindfulness now quite a lot in the corporate world. And it's now slowly starting to be okay to say, you know, oh, I need to sort the head out for this game. And so is it in more now? It is definitely, but from asking around my network, I'd say it's still not where it could be, I think.
Okay, so there's still some gains there to be had then for people that are willing to look into that side of things.
For sure. It would be great to speak to some of the, you know, the likes of Gwynny and things like that, because his head is very, very strong, isn't it? You know, and he is also very, very successful in the sport. So is it because of his head, or is it because he's loads better on a bike than everybody else? I know what my answer would be.
Yeah, I think there's got to be a bit of everything. I don't think people generally, not these days anyway, win through just one factor. There's a lot of things involved in getting to the bottom of the hill fastest.
For sure.
Cool. Interesting. So you travelled out to the World Champs, I think, this last year. Is that right, with British Cycling?
Yeah. I was fortunate enough to get the invite to the Champs. I think my title, the job title they gave me when I was over there, was Performance Analyst. And it was me and Rich Thomas, which people who've ridden in downhill will know Rich from back in the day as well.
Yeah, familiar name. So what kind of stuff does a performance analyst get up to at the Cairns World Champs then?
Making breakfast. definitely a bit of everything. You know, we chip in. In fact, Fiona, who was doing the breakfast, will hate me to say that, so I won't claim to making breakfast. We were involved in a lot of things. Obviously, it's just trying to make the whole process and the whole side of things more comfortable for them, for the riders. Now, one of the main things is on track. So that's from the start gate to the finish gate was mine and Rich Thomas's kind of abode, if you like. And we spent hours up there from doing the track walk through to filming. And probably one of the most effective bits was timing up there, which was absolutely awesome. And I wish we had more of us to do more timing or more bits of track for the British team, to be honest. And then through to, like, at the end of the day, we then show people the videos and have open conversations with the riders, to see, not just to go, well, this line's faster, you know, that definitely was not why we were up there, you know. And at the end of the day, you've got experienced riders like G. Atherton, Danny Hart, that have done it many years before. before. So it wasn't a matter of going to them just saying, oh yeah, do the high line. It was more a matter of saying, well, you know, this is the evidence we've got. We've timed people on the high line. We've timed people on the low line. Some riders found the high, you know, were fast on the low line, some were high on it. You get my point. So we it was about being very open with the riders, but showing them, laying down the evidence, and then letting them decide. For me, the most important thing was, and it comes back to the mental side of things, especially with the juniors on the team, was making them themselves feel 100% confident of the line they've chosen, which personally I think is more important than even picking the one, as people call it. It wasn't about the one. It was about, okay, which one do you feel you can give 100% to on your race run? So that's the more important one for them.
Interesting. What kind of timing kit are you using then? Is there anything kind of sophisticated there, or is it stopwatches and that side of things?
Yeah, stopwatches. It would have been hard to put any proper timing down. Maybe it's possible, but I think with interference of the, you know, of the time that they have on track kind of thing. So more stopwatches. And so it wasn't absolutely perfect, but what we were looking for were ballparks. So I'll give you an example. We were timing the rock section, was a bit that was one of the main sections in Australia that you remember at the top there. And so we were timing from before the entry, so further up, because we wanted to make sure we include breaking points. And then all the way through to the end of the next straight, which was, I can't remember the tree they called it now, but the tree that had loads of roots coming off, and that was kind of the end of the straight.
The alien tree.
That's the one, thank you. So, we were timing that full section, and it was something in and around of, was it 15 or 18 seconds, just under 20 seconds anyway. The point being, though, is we would find out the time. So we'd say, okay, so what, you know, a certain rider would come through on 18 seconds, and then we'd find out there'd be an analyst in the middle of the track as well saying, or the middle of the rocks saying, which entry they did. So were they high in and low out, or low in and high out, so on. And then it would just, so we'd have then end up with kind of 20 or more figures and 20 riders and where they'd gone. And then we'd just take the averages. So we'd say the people who were running high in and low out were more likely to be under the 18 second barrier or whatever it was. It was interesting. We were kind of, to be honest, figuring out as we went, because it was the first year that British Cycling had put two people that were riders on that role kind of thing. So me and Richard T were figuring it out and asking the riders what they wanted, as well as, you know, trying to put in some ideas that we thought of.
Cool. And are the other nations doing similar kind of stuff? Do you spot a lot of people out on track with stopwatches and video cameras and stuff, or are British Cycling ahead of the game?
There are definitely others as well. And it was a laugh because it was we had the microphones so me and Richie T were speaking over the mic, and we were speaking down to the pits, the riders and things like that. And we'd always have to, especially there was quite a big French support out there as well. So we were always having to sort of keep it quiet when we were speaking over the mic and things like that. It sounds funny, but at the time it was also funny, to be fair. But as well, you know, we don't want them taking our ideas. They can find out their own information.
Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, anything that you can keep that's an advantage is good to have, right?
Exactly.
Cool. And any other interesting observations that you made while you're out there?
I'd say probably track-wise, if we just carry on speaking about track, that again, you know, if you look at all of the lines down there, all of the riders, and these are obviously the top riders in the world, are all doing different lines. And right. And so although, yeah, we were timing and we were trying to find the right lines, you know, I hear people, you know, when you're at smaller events, even national or grassroots racing, and, you know, and they get almost overly stressed about what the line is they're on. And it is important. Don't get me wrong. It is very important. But it's not the only thing. You know, riding the track fast and knowing what's underneath you and being confident with what's underneath you is actually more important than anything. So that was one thing. Other than that, yeah, just probably differences. You definitely see, again, you know, it doesn't seem like, I think in other sports, there's very much a one way to do it. And I don't just mean about line choice now. I'm talking about, you know, everything from the riders that the riders do through the whole race weekend. And in other sports, it looks a little bit more exact. You know, there is a way that a tennis player will do all of their things from nutrition through to training, through to, you know, practice and all of those, and then obviously competing. But I would say looking around at that level, there isn't kind of only one way. And possibly my assumption for that is that we are still a very new sport. So we don't have those years and years and years of sort of building like one method for being the fastest. So yeah, that's probably one of the other things definitely noticed out there.
Yeah, you do still see a lot of different styles, you know, even body position on bike. People tend to ride things slightly differently or look different. And then there's obviously a lot of creativity in line choice. You know, Sam Hill is famous for finding interesting lines through stuff that maybe no one else can spot. So yeah, it's interesting to hear you talk about multiple lines on the Cairns track as well, because I think, you know, a lot of people perceive it to be maybe one of the easier tracks or a bit one line. So yeah, it's good to hear that people are still mixing it up.
Oh, definitely. And so, and you mentioned Sam Hill. He was obviously on his trail bike, wasn't he? So he based and the reason he did so well, was he fifth in the end, or
fifth or sixth? Around. Might have been sixth. Yeah.
But you know, there's people thinking he was going to win it at one point, and what he was doing, he was finding the smoothest line down the track. He wasn't looking for any of the difficult lines that, again, I think, you know, definitely at grassroots level, a lot of riders will just look for the hardest line and think that's the fastest line. Sam Hill would have went the easiest down most of the track, maybe not easiest over some of those jumps, but yeah, the smoothest line down that track. So, you know, and it worked for him.
Interesting. Yeah, maybe maintaining more flow and carrying more continuous speed, perhaps.
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. So let's talk a little bit about coaching. Obviously, you spend plenty of time doing that. I'm interested to know if there's any kind of common mistakes that you see when you start coaching people. Are there certain things that you see in a lot of individuals, or is it very very personalised?
There's probably, first thing is, depends what level you're talking about. So obviously, you know, dropping away from the kind of British cycling team and moving on to, yeah, as you say, the coaching that I do through Pro Ride, the common things are that I've found an answer why I think people do this, but people just ride too close to the bike. They ride in the bike rather than above it. And I think quite simply the reason they do that is because, one, a fear thing. If you're closer to the floor, you're less likely to you know, you haven't got as far to fall, kind of thing, so it's not scary. But as well, I think what they, when they watch mountain biking, I think they see the position of the riders when they're, say, going over an obstacle, such as, you know, squashing over a rock or root or whatever it may be. Yeah. And allowing the bike to come to them, they see that movement and think that's the main movement you've got to be in. And what I've been working with many riders recently is actually turning that around, that's the obstacle position as such, if we were to just broaden it to just calling it obstacles. And then the important thing is the position after that, you know, where you finish on the bike. And that's standing really positive through your legs and making sure that there's space between you and the bike, so the bike can actually move very freely underneath you. And that's the aim, really, that any rider, gravity-fed rider, will be looking for is getting that bike to move freely. That's both up and down and leaning left and right. And to carry on that sort of point, really, that you've got people always say, oh, you know, the likes of Greg Minnaar, it just looks like he's not even going over bumps. And, you know, again, because he's a tall rider, he's got his legs a nice, comfortable distance away, you know, a very straightened and away from the bike, and then he can allow the bike to move underneath him. Whereas if you watch not just newer riders, but many riders, they ride very close to the bike, and it's pretty detrimental to it.
Okay, so using your levers, effectively your arms and your legs, to give the bike more room, I suppose, more travel, effectively.
Absolutely, yeah. When people have heard terminology like get low on the bike, and that's absolutely right. At times, you know, into corners and stuff, you want to get low. But what we're mostly speaking about when you're saying get low is get your the front, so your chest lower, and your, you know, get lower in your arms. It's not necessarily, depending on the piece of trail, it's not necessarily get low on your legs, which I think is the mistake a lot of people make.
Okay. And do you think kind of mobility and strength weighs in on that as well? Are people, in compromised positions because their body maybe doesn't let them get where they need to be?
Yeah, it definitely has an impact. And the coaching that I do, we work with people loads around the kind of, you know, that standing position on a bike and of many different ages as well. And I guess movement levels with that. And yes, so it does restrict you, but as one person once called the positioning that I showed him, he said, this is my Morzine rest position. So this is the position I'm in when I'm knackered and I'm just getting to the bottom. So I was like, well, there we go. We need to use that Morzine rest position a little bit more often.
Oh, right. Okay. So he actually found that fairly comfortable as a position then where he should be, but he wasn't using it.
Absolutely. Yeah. You try standing in a squat position for a few minutes and I'm sure you'd be very fatigued. Whereas if you just stand with your legs straighter, then you're, I'm assuming you could do it all day.
Interesting. I'll have to give that a try. Cool. And any other observations from the world of coaching around things that people often do wrong or do badly?
Yeah. To be fair, I have there's loads, but I guess one of the other things is around jumping. There's many sort of things around jumping where people I did an airtime course last weekend actually, and it was quite interesting because at the end of the course, the riders were saying, "So jumping equals jumping, yeah?" And I said, "Exactly, yeah." And what they meant by that is if I get people to do this now, but if you just jumped, not on the bike, tried to jump as high as you could, you would jump and you'd make your hips go nice and high. And in other words, everything above your hips is your mass, isn't it? So your main sort of your torso and your main weight. When that goes high, obviously you go high. So if you're on a bike, if you actually jump and actually try to get your hips high, the bike will also go high. I'd say this to anybody and yourself, feel free to watch people ride and maybe more amateur riders do jumps and then they question and see what they're doing and you'll see that their hips aren't rising. It'll be that they're actually make, if anything, the squash position with like bending your legs, but they're just, you know, obviously using a bit of speed to get a bit of air rather than actually jumping. So yeah, jumping equals jumping.
So you're popping away from the bike almost as you're taking off, is that what you're getting?
Absolutely
at?
It's about getting your hips high. Yeah your mass on a bike, and it's worth if I was to say to watch something with you know, when you watch either the World Cups or the EWS, to analyze people's torso, so what they're doing with that, and then the legs obviously, but if you analyze their torso, you will see what's going on. So when they're hitting the jumps, they will want their torso to go up because it's all about getting into the air. It's definitely a good one to review.
Yeah, interesting. Well, that's one for me to look at. Jumping's definitely a weakness, so I'll have to go and have a play with that.
You'll have to come and join us one day, Chris.
Well, yeah, definitely. I'd be well up for sure. That'd be cool. Nice one. We're getting close to the end of our time, but we've got a few questions that we've asked most of our guests, so we'll hit those. The first one is, if our audience had £100 to spend to help improve their performance on the bike, what would you recommend they spend it on? I'm guessing you're going to say coaching.
It's going to be a bit of an easy. Obviously, you have to come and spend it with Pro Ride and do some coaching with us, definitely. But if you're relating to, are you relating to bike or around bike?
Either, I think. Anything that's ultimately going to help them ride faster and or have more fun.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, good point. To be fair, it would be something around bike. I don't want to encourage coaching because obviously it sounds a bit too blatant. But, you know, whether it's coaching, it's, you know, not just chimp management, but some psychological support or training, you know, getting a trainer. And I know you've spoken to a few already. That side of things is huge, and it's so much more important than the tires that you use. I've ridden with people before and they'll change the tires three times on the first three or four runs of a race weekend, and it's just completely not needed. It will, and okay, if you talk extremes, you know, if it's really really wet versus really really dry, obviously wet tires are going to be better in the wet and dry in the dry, but if it's a certain condition, even a dry-ish or intermediate condition, any downhill related tire will be okay. Just some might get you down, I don't know, a second or quicker or whatever. So it's not, yeah, it's not the be all and end all. Don't focus on the bike. Focus on you and the stuff around the bike before actually focusing on the bike. I know even when I say that, though, I know most people will still just go out and buy themselves an expensive bike because that's obviously, that's probably the easier thing to do and it's the minimal effort thing other than obviously the financial side of things. But definitely there's a, it's work on you first and then the bike.
Yeah, well, and it's lower effort, isn't it? It's easy to throw money at product and assume it's going to make you faster. It's a lot harder to look inside your head or take your body to the gym and give it a good workout. So it's it takes some motivation to take that kind of off-bike approach.
Absolutely, yeah.
Cool. Number two is, if you could roll back the clock and have a chat with your 16-year-old self, what advice would you give him?
That's a really good question. Very tough, because I'm reflecting on two things. Probably one thing I'd say, probably back then for me, it would be party less, which would be probably the honest truth. That back then, you know, that obviously that side of life was a little bit more than maybe my sport. But then if I'm perfectly honest, if that's the thing that you need to do at that time in your life, then go and do that. So this is why I'm split on this question, really, because there's probably two things. If you want to be a professional mountain biker, and then you're just going to have to choose all of those, you know, the various things that we've spoken about today to help yourself progress through the sport and get to the top. But actually, what I'd highly advise is try to find what your stronger values are and do those at the time of your life. So don't, what I'm basically saying is, don't fight yourself. If you've got something you want to do, go and do it wrong, and then you'll learn more about that than trying to do something that you don't want to do, but somebody's telling you you have to.
Yeah, if it makes you happy and it's not illegal, crack on.
Oh, completely, yeah.
Job done. All right, last one. If you could choose anyone, past or present, for a coaching session, who would it be and why? and what would you want to learn?
Yeah, I like your style, past or present. It's probably got to be past, bearing in mind I'm an old person in this sport, or should I say an older person in the elite side of this sport. Do you know what? In fact, to be fair, I'm going to relate to, I actually had a masterclass with Fabien Borel years ago.
Oh, awesome. Interesting.
Really, really interesting. Like, I think it was about 3 days. It was like at least all weekend anyway. And it was in the UK, unfortunately, because the weather was rubbish. But the guy, I really liked what he did. And generally, I'm not starstruck by people. You know, a person's a person, whatever you are, you know, and it doesn't really matter. But I grew a real high level of respect and was probably more starstruck from Fabien at the end of the weekend than I was the beginning.
Okay, interesting.
And I guess the reason for that was just, he's quite a spiritual chap, as everyone could probably tell from speaking to him and hearing his, stuff online and things. But the spiritual side of things, his ability to be a great coach and a great people person, even though he is also, and especially at the time, who just come off the back of a world championship, I think, one of the best riders in the world and one of the fastest people. So he kind of had that rounded side of him that he wasn't just fast on the bike. He wasn't just good to talk to. He wasn't just a good coach. He didn't have other, good things around him. It was the whole package, really. So yeah, I'd go back to Fabien Borel again, please.
Very cool. And what's the biggest thing you took away from that kind of has stuck with you?
Quite interesting, yeah. Probably some of the stuff that I now coach, and somebody asked me about this the other day, and it's some of the stuff that we've even spoken about today around a kind of body positioning and things like that. So that's the literal stuff that I took from him on for like how to ride, if you like. But the other side, I say the other side of it was just, yeah, like I say, that importance of being around a person, I think, was the biggest thing that I took from him, and the importance that, you know, not just to focus on one thing in your life and actually try to focus on the you and who you are and, you know, and how you are in society and with your friends and with your family and, you know, and get that bit right, because the rest of it will then follow.
Interesting. Good stuff. Well, thanks for your time today. It's been awesome to chat some really interesting stuff and some different insight into the mountain bike world for sure. If people want to keep in touch and follow what you're up to, whereabouts can they find you on the internet?
Yeah, so easy enough to find on the internet nowadays, I suppose. So Instagram is OllieM1. Facebook, I think, is my full name, using Oliver Morris. To be fair, also on the Intense website, there's plenty of stuff on there, and I think contact details and things like that on there. So feel free to give us a shout. The other thing, obviously, through my website being proridemtb.com, obviously more contact details on there.
Awesome. And what kind of courses do you offer, just out of interest?
Five main courses we offer. So it's Progress, Flow, we do one called Tech, one called Airtime, and a downhill speed one that I've been running at Kumkan recently, which has been really good fun. And then on top of that, private days are great. I really enjoy them. When you get people back and you keep a bit of a program for them, you can really take them through some sort of solid progression, if you know what I mean.
Awesome. Good stuff. And can people drop in at any kind of point? They don't have to start on one course and work their way through. They can just pick which one they want to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's kind of the idea. It's funny though, I've had people that have dropped in on a course, a little bit further up, if you like, coming on Tech. And then they almost, often it's the case that even though you're already quite quick, actually getting the fundamentals and the basics right, like in anything in life, is really important.
Yeah, I agree. I did the exact same with A-Line coaching a couple of years ago. Mm. I started on their Tech course and then ended up going backwards through their three different courses and doing the fundamentals and the Flow course as well. And they're all really good. So yeah, definitely. Cool. Brilliant. Nice one. Thanks a lot for your time today. It's been super interesting chatting. All the best for 2018 and racing and enjoying life. And thanks for your time.
Brilliant. Good to speak to you, Chris. Thank you.
Well, that's it for episode 27. I hope you enjoyed it and found it interesting. If you did, then let us know on social media, give us an iTunes review, and don't forget to tune in a couple of weeks for our next great episode. But until then, get out and ride.